You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Atheistically Speaking. This is episode 266 and I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, before we get to part two with Lindsay on EvoPsych, very interesting topic, I just want to let my patrons know and anyone who is thinking about becoming a patron at patreon.com/atheist that I've got a great bonus content with Eli. It's going to be really, it's pretty funny. We had a really interesting, funny discussion and patrons will also get early access to a special announcement being made, and that's all I'll say. But so patrons get it early. That'll be out sometime this week. And so if you want to check that out, please feel free to check out the Patreon. All right, here is part two with Lindsay.
A general theme that came up about the fact that we aren't testing theories.
That EvoPsych is not testing theories?
Yeah, that our methods don't lend themselves to actually testing theories. There's a couple of things to be said about this.
Sure.
One is that in hypothesis testing, or like when you're doing science, it's true to say that a study does not test a theory. That is actually true. But the way in which it's true is not how it was being presented, I don't think. So a theory is like this broad general framework for synthesizing a bunch of different observations. So like evolutionary theory, for instance, right? That's like a very broad thing, right? A very broad set of principles that describes a whole lot of things. No individual study is directly testing evolutionary theory. Rather, we're deriving hypotheses and then from that predictions from this theory that then can be tested individually, and over a great number of tests, you can support a theory or fail to support it.
Right. But so is EvoPsych in a position that's maybe more difficult than other sciences where, I mean, when we have the, like, how much, I think one of the biggest criticisms is like, oh, EvoPsych is just a bunch of just-so stories. And yes. How do you test between them? You know, like between explanations. Could you talk about that at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So that's true. And probably for those reasons that we talked about at the beginning, that it's fairly easy to make up adaptive stories about different things. That is a true thing. But it's not equally easy to provide evidence for all of those stories.
Sure.
And so when we're coming up with hypotheses, what we are doing is not saying, well, we think this is why it's happening and then just leaving it there. We're coming up with this hypothesis about what this hypothetical psychological adaptation might look like in terms of its structure and function. And then we're making specific predictions about the particular things that you should see, characterizing the relationship between two things, given any number of constraints that you want to come up with. And those predictions are very specific and are falsifiable. And if they are falsified, then we say, look, we did not provide evidence that this is part of the specific adaptation that we hypothesized about.
Are there any theories or anything that come to mind that have been falsified through studies or tests or whatever in EvoPsych?
Yeah, so there's a highly, highly heated or controversial area of research on evolutionary explanations of rape. You can see how why this would be a charged topic. Yeah. But one hypothesis that was offered at one point was the disadvantaged male hypothesis. So the idea was that if you can't reproduce through female choice, then you should try to subvert that choice and rape. There has been absolutely no evidence presented for this hypothesis. So they've looked at whether like indices of mate value, for instance, predict likelihood of raping. They've looked at like actual success and to see if that predicts, you know, the likelihood of somebody becoming a rapist. But none of these predictions panned out.
Really?
And so this hypothesis has fallen out of favor. I know, right? So you're surprised because that sounded like a totally reasonable suggestion, right?
Right.
Yeah, but it didn't bear out. The evidence didn't support it.
Interesting. So there are people still trying to hang on to it, or? You mentioned that it was very controversial, so it sounds that sounds like not terribly controversial, because if the evidence doesn't bear it out, then I guess it's not true.
But well, there's still research going on the biological underpinnings of rape. And so the controversy is really over, like, whether you should be approaching rape from that position, right? And people are very uncomfortable with that. So that's what's controversial about it. Not necessarily that specific hypothesis.
Oh, okay. But I see. Just the research at all? Just the idea that, yeah, okay.
Hmm. Yeah. People get very uncomfortable with that. Probably because of, the fact that intuition that we talked about, that if you explain something biologically, it sounds like you're saying, well, it's natural, and so we should let everyone rape as much as they want. Like that's not the implication, right?
Right. Obviously. And I would want to know, like, I would want to study psychopathy or something. I would want to study, even what makes people pedophiles or something. It doesn't mean that it's okay. It just means maybe you'd be able to have some insights about helping those people or explaining it or whatever it is, you know?
Right. Exactly.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't really understand that pushback. That's kind of weird to me.
Well, I mean, you do though, right?
No, I mean, of course I understand you.
I think that we kind of want to stay mad at bad behavior.
Yeah.
And like Sam Harris has talked about, when you provide a clear explanation of why somebody did something bad, the anger dissipates in a lot of cases. And I think that people are uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. I mean, I totally understand that people are that way. I'm just saying I'm not, like, I don't.
It doesn't, I don't have that intuition anymore either, but yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, I could certainly imagine it being difficult if I or a family member were the victim of something. Like, I could understand thinking, like, oh, I just can't get it out of my head that this person, you know, is responsible. And yeah, I understand that. But if the question is, in general, should we study this? It's like, well, yeah, of course, you know.
Agreed.
Like, so, interesting. Okay.
Absolutely agreed. And also, so this is relevant to testing as well. Like, he talked about kin selection and homosexuality and the research on that. And he was saying that, like, evolutionary psychology, he was kind of representing it as a monolith, and that as a monolith, we were saying, no, we reject the kin selection theory of homosexuality. But again, that's not really what's happening.
Well, what is happening?
Okay, I will tell you. I mean, but I want to qualify this. Like, the kin selection theory of homosexuality is an ev-psych theory.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yeah. Kin selection is, like, a huge explanatory principle in evolutionary psychology.
Hmm.
There's a ton of research supporting it as a hypothesis, right? Like, as a general hypothesis, not about homosexuality in particular, but, like, as a general theory for explaining behavior. Like, it's incredibly powerful. It changed the study of behavior.
Give us a quick refresh on it. I remember as regards homosexuality, but I can't think off the top of my head, like, how it apply to other things. But so give us a quick refresher if you don't mind.
Yeah. Okay. So there was a classical conception of what genetic fitness meant that equated it with a particular individual's reproductive success relative to the population. And so that's the way that fitness was conceptualized for a really long time. But then a couple of problems presented themselves, which were that, like, you know, people do things that are not in their self-interest, right? They engage in altruistic behaviors that are costly to themselves and that benefit other people. And that from, you know, the perspective of this classical idea of fitness, everything that you should do should be in your own self-interest.
Right.
Right. But then kin selection was proposed, right, and raised the idea of inclusive fitness. So this is the revised way to understand fitness. So under this conception, genetic fitness is not at the level of the individual. That's not where selection's taking place. Selection's actually taking place at the level of the gene. And you share your unique genes with other people, right, your close kin. And so according to this theory, you should get certain behaviors that that promote the survivability and reproducibility of kin, as well as of the self, right?
So, because it's, yeah, okay. So I remember how that functions with homosexuality. It can, I think the theory was, right, that fit males or females that don't choose a partner, essentially, and stay with the, like, family unit boost the fitness of those genes, I guess, right?
Right. Yeah.
So are there any other, what other behavior besides homosexuality is possibly explained by this?
Yeah, well, I mean, helping behavior would be one thing. So people are much more likely to be altruistic toward people who share their kin than people who don't. And you also get like a linear relationship with helping behavior and the degree of genes shared. So like you're most likely to help people that share 50% of your genes, which is your offspring and your siblings. And then you're slightly less likely to help first cousins, right? And then you're slightly less likely to help second cousins and so on, right? So as your relatedness with somebody decreases, your helping behavior toward them decreases. And the idea is that like when you help somebody, you're helping your genes in their body, essentially.
Got it.
At least in the case of kin selection, right?
Right.
So, I mean, there's non-kin cooperation and reciprocity that we can talk about later if you want to. But yeah, that's the idea of kin selection, that we will do things to help our genes regardless of whether they're in our body or somebody else's.
Okay, so how did Carrier present? Because I remember him talking about this, and then so did he say that evolutionary psychologists are rejecting this theory, even though it's like a resounding success or something like that?
Yes, I think the quote was something like, "What evolutionary psychology has done is get together and say, no, this is refuted," as though we have some sort of ideological stake in refuting kin selection, right? Which is not true. Like, this hypothesis has a lot of intuitive appeal, and if the evidence bore it out, we would totally embrace it, right? And it still might. I mean, there's a lot of inconsistencies in the literature about what best predicts this. So you, I mean, and the funny thing is that like all of this stuff is coming out in evolutionary psychology journals, the stuff that provides evidence.
So it's a battle within evolutionary psychology. So it would be wrong to blame the field one way or the other, because it is just a debate within the field, right? Is that what you're saying?
It is, right? Just like any other scientific question, right? You're going to have people that have different perspectives on this and are trying to provide evidence for or against it. And eventually the side that has the most evidence on its side, you know, that'll start being taught in textbooks as like, yeah, this seems to have a lot of support for it.
Right.
Right. But he said that this was a classic example of evolutionary psych being a pseudoscience because they rejected this out of hand and ignored evidence, which just isn't true. You even have like some of the same research teams that are testing this hypothesis across different cultures, and they're finding inconsistent results, and they're publishing on them. They're like, look, this is consistent with kin selection. This one doesn't seem to be consistent with kin selection. So
interesting. So yeah, you can't possibly blame the field for that one, then, it sounds like.
I wouldn't call it a pseudoscience based on this. Right?
Sure. No, and to the contrary, that sounds like a healthy science if they're investigating the theory and publishing results that go either way, like whatever it is, they're saying, well, this is consistent with it, this isn't. So that sounds like an emerging theory kind of thing. It's either going to stand the test of time or die, like you said.
Exactly. Right.
Interesting. I wonder why he thought that. Do you get the impression that he just accepts kin selection and then is therefore just looking at the people arguing against it and saying like, oh, what are you doing?
I really don't know.
Hmm. Interesting. It's just
like,
weird.
I'd like to hear why. I mean, it's possible there's something about this debate that I'm missing. And so Richard, if you end up listening to this, please get in touch.
Cool. Yeah, I bet I could make that happen. So what is your stance on kin selection? Is it just kind of agnostic? Are you, you know, what is your personal stance on it?
On kin selection in general for homosexuality?
I guess either. I don't know.
I mean, kin selection as a theory is incredibly well established. Like this is a way that genes get passed on. The preponderance of the evidence is on that side, and it's a very well-tested thing. Not just in humans, but in other species. So it's a very powerful explanation for behavior.
But it's just a question of specific behavior that the theory is unsure on, or that the evidence is not in.
So you could potentially make the prediction based on kin selection that this could be a way that homosexuality gets selected for. It could be a kin selected mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I can tell, I mean, there's evidence that's consistent with that, and there's evidence that's not.
So how did it get established as a firm method of gene selection, yet not established as, you know, like what, so how was that established initially? Is it mathematical models or something?
Oh,
statistical
partly.
Models?
Yeah. I mean, so you can look at, there was a classic study with ground squirrels, and one observation that had been made about ground squirrels was that they tend to give off these alarm calls when a predator is near, right? Mm. Now, these alarm calls are great for the other ground squirrels, right? Because they know that there's a predator coming. But it's not so good for the particular ground squirrel that makes that call.
Yeah,
because
interesting.
That will alert the predator to where they are and they'll get eaten. So from a kin selection perspective, you can make sense out of this maladaptive behavior by saying, okay, so if they're doing this call to rescue their own genes, right, in other ground squirrels' bodies, then we should be able to see differences in likelihood of alarm calling in situations in which more kin or fewer kin are around, like controlling for how many ground squirrels are around. And there was a number of other alternative hypotheses that are not coming to mind right now, but they did studies in which they looked at the associations between likelihood of somebody admitting this alarm call. And one of the things that they looked at the relationship between was how many ground squirrels overall were there versus how many ground squirrels that were close genetic relatives were there. And they saw that the alarm calls were more likely if there were a high proportion of genetic relatives around.
That's interesting. How would that work? Like, are they really somehow making the decision to make an alarm call based on that, or just that
no.
isn't evolved? That
right.
hasn't been selected for as much. But how are you testing that environment, like, in the time it takes for that to evolve? You know, like, we're testing just environments right now, right? Like, how
That's
could
true.
You be sure that, you know, I guess I'm confused on how we would be able to know that.
On how we'd know whether it was an adapted mechanism?
Well, no, on how, so if I totally get the theory, and it makes sense that if this alarm call, which is bad for the individual organism, you know, but is good for its kin, I get that theory, and it makes sense. But I don't get how you would say, okay, so let's test areas where there's squirrels with a lot of kin around versus not. And then know that, because like I would think, okay, this behavior has evolved in whatever species you're looking at it, and it would still apply regardless of the current environment of the squirrel.
Oh no, I mean not environment in a general sense, but like if you have a situation in which you've got a group of ground squirrels out gathering and a predator comes, right?
Oh, like so then it does modulate its behavior based on. That then. So it's
somehow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, that was the first thing I said. So it's somehow changing it will change its behavior on this like emergency call, given it's how many kin are around.
Exactly.
Okay. Sorry. I thought you said no to that initially, which was why I was confused, but I may have just spoken clumsily. Okay. So that's interesting. Yeah. Totally makes sense.
So that's just an example, but there's been a number of demonstrations that you can predict behavior that on its surface seems somewhat maladaptive, or at least, you know, too costly to be sustained for the individual's fitness. But then when you look at it in the context of what that behavior is doing for close genetic kin, you can predict these costly behaviors. Right. And that holds in humans. Like you see, if you do surveys of like how likely people are to have done these very costly helping behaviors or even risky helping behaviors like saving somebody's life, disproportionately people that are very close genetic relatives are the recipients of those behaviors as opposed to distant genetic relatives or non-kin.
Interesting. Okay. So then it's just the current testing now is just a question of trying to fit that model into different areas of behavior like homosexuality or whatever it is.
And yeah, exactly.
Test
right.
results are still pending on some
exactly,
of that.
Exactly. Right.
Okay.
So that's like a theory that you can use to make predictions about specific domains of behavior.
Gotcha.
Essentially. And it may or may not apply to a specific behavior.
So yeah, I'll count that one as I'm confused. I would need more information as to why Carrier thought that was a strike on EvoPsych when it sounds like it's from your description, it sounds like it's just a debate within EvoPsych, and I don't know why you would fault one side or the other.
Or rather, like more than a debate, I just say that we're still collecting evidence on it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I don't know that anybody's making particularly firm statements about, you know, whether or not
one way or the other.
I mean, I might be wrong about this. The homosexuality question is not something that I've spent a lot of time looking into or researching. I just read a handful of articles for this. But as far as I can tell, there is still research being conducted both like surrounding whether or not kin selection is a good explanation for homosexuality. And there seems to be evidence on both sides.
Okay.
So this was another point under the, you know, the testing theories idea. So one was what I just said, right? We actually test specific predictions, and then if those hold up, they support theories, right? But the other thing is that, so this was more an issue in his article than it was in the podcast, but there was a lot of him taking particular methods sort of point by point and pointing out the limitations in each of those methods, a lot of which was valid, right? There are a ton of limitations to using self-report methods, for instance, or testing a question in a non-representative sample, right? All those things are true. But I think one of the things that he misses is that your evidence for a particular hypothesis or a theory comes from convergent evidence from a bunch of different types of methodologies. And all of those different methodologies have specific limitations, but they have different limitations. They have complementary limitations.
Hmm.
So if you find support from a variety of different methodologies that converge on a single explanation, you have very good evidence, but it seemed like the,
even though you can pick apart like one of the, you know, you can say, oh, this study doesn't count on this or that. Yeah. Take this into account. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you can do that with every single study in existence. That's absolutely true. But if you take the cumulative weight of a bunch of different studies from different perspectives, you have convergent evidence. So it seemed to me, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but like, it seemed to me like he was saying, look, when you add up all these flawed methodologies, all you get is a bunch of flaws. You don't get any knowledge, but that's not really true.
Yeah, it's sort of like just thinking back to Greatest Show on Earth. It's sort of like dating stuff. You know, when you're trying to date a rock or you're trying to date some sort of something. We had all these different methodologies, like tree rings, like that we could date when a climate event happened. And it's like, well, there's could be flaws with that method, but then you compare it to another method of dating that shows the same results at the same period of time, even though that method may have its own flaws, the fact that they both show the same thing is very strong evidence for that particular like time frame.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Right. And I think that we're fairly cognizant of that in this field.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of there are certain difficulties when you're trying to argue that a feature of the mind is an adaptation versus a feature of the body. You can see the feature of the body.
Mm-hmm.
You can't necessarily see the feature of the mind. And so because of that, like, I feel like we're pretty tuned into these problems and we emphasize a lot like the power of convergent evidence. I'm not saying that other fields don't, but I'm saying this is a salient thing that we're aware of. And I don't want people to think that we just, you know, don't know that it's important to do cross-cultural research, for instance.
Yeah, that was one thing he kept saying, like, that all these studies are just, you know, what was it, like, white, oh, what do they call it? I can't
weirdos.
Remember.
Weird,
yeah. White.
White, educated, industrialized, yeah. Something.
Something yeah. Or other, yeah. So what do you think about that? I mean, is that the case? Are there too many studies on just plain old white people?
It's definitely a valid criticism if that's the only thing that you're doing. And I think that, you know, as a field, it's been pointed out many times, and it's very true that a lot of the initial research in psychology was done on those types of populations. But I think that we might be less guilty of it in evolutionary than other fields.
Hmm.
And the reason I say that is that we are often drawing on information that we've gathered from like anthropological studies, comparative studies, like comparative as in interspecies comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that like if you took a random sample of studies that are using cross-cultural methods within psychology, it's actually probably disproportionately more likely to be evolutionary. I don't know that for sure. I mean, and there is a lot of like cross-cultural research is an actual subdomain in psychology. So maybe that's unfair. But we are very tuned into the fact that it's important to do that. Now, having said that, it is not true to say that it is completely valueless to do an initial study of an effect in, like, say, a population of United States college students. Like, you need to put the appropriate qualifications on that, but you can gain valuable information from looking at that population.
Mm-hmm.
right? So he made the point a bunch of times that like our current environment does not represent the ancestral environment. And that's absolutely true. And that's always on the forefront of our minds. But it doesn't represent the ancestral environment in very specific ways. And when you hypothesize about a particular psychological adaptation, you're making specific predictions about how that adaptation might manifest in the current environment a lot of times. So it's not like we just can't know how an adaptation is going to interact in the current environment. That's not true. I can give an example.
Oh, sure.
Of a very good area of research that I actually would say is one of the best examples that have come out of this evolutionary perspective on human behavior. There are many, but how do you feel about incest, Thomas?
Ooh, interesting. Mm. Well, I don't partake myself.
No?
No.
Any particular reason for that?
Yeah, it just seems like it's one of those instincts, huh?
No, I mean, it could be cultural. That was a suggestion for a long time, that it was just, you know, cultures have incest taboos, and that's a thing, and so yeah. People don't have sex with their siblings because of that.
Whereas, like, the Targaryens, for example.
Oh, my God. All right.
To name
Game
a different
Thrones
culture.
Comes up yeah. So much in evolutionary psychology. You have no idea. All the time.
Is that I'm not sure if that's more indicative of a pseudoscience or a healthy science. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So do you have siblings?
Yeah.
And do you enjoy having sex with them on a regular basis?
As regular as I can. You know, it's not it's we're not available, you know, stuff like that. It's hard to find time. But yeah, sure.
Yeah. No, I could hear the disgust in your initial reaction. And that's fine. Don't feel ashamed. Yeah. No, I think that it's a fairly common thing that people feel disgusted by this.
Yeah. Right?
And so I want to like – so for a very long time, though, this was attributed to incest taboos. And so the idea was that like if you didn't have these cultural mechanisms prohibiting incest, then people would just have sex with everybody, including their siblings.
Yeah.
But in the late 1800s – a researcher named Westermark made an observation, which was that people seem to be naturally disgusted by the idea of having sex with people that they've grown up with.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I never in any part of my life can I remember anyone needing to tell me that. Like, and I know that's anecdotal, but it's like,
it's also important.
It would have been, if that were true, it seems like it would be one of those things that your parents would need to tell you when you were like five, you know? Cause like,
yeah, and they'd have to correct you. Right?
Yeah, because like toddlers are always like doing weird shit, like just, you know, pulling out their genitals and no, you can't do it. You got it. We're, you know, all this stuff that's culturally taught. But that's, I don't think that's something that really, I don't know. Who knows? I don't remember needing to be taught it is the point.
No, I had the same intuition.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just an intuition, mm-hmm. right? So he suggested this very specific thing. He's like, maybe we have an innate mechanism that keeps us from being sexually attracted to the people that we grow up with,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's like a specific hypothesis about a psychological module and how it will work, right?
Yeah.
Do you know why incest is bad? Like, why?
Well, don't our...
It's kind of more condescending than I meant it to.
Yeah. Now, do you know... Now, honey, do you know why... Yeah. Do you mean like, biologically why it's bad? Or are you trying to get me to come up with a moral justification?
No,
because like, that is interesting because this crosses, disciplines because I know in moral philosophy, this is something they talk about too, because it's like, this is proof that in some cases your philosophical justification comes after this feeling, you know?
Yes.
So like when you ask people like, oh, why is incest bad? They try to come up with, you know, some explanation and then you go, well, what about just the consenting brother and sister, you know, using condoms, no chance of, you know, and you go on down the list and people just still are like, nah, it's just wrong.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah,
it's interesting.
All right. We're going to get into why that is, I think, or at least, you know.
Oh, well, I mean, it seems pretty straightforward to me, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but so, okay. But so again, like the components of this explanation for incest avoidance are going to have a couple of different, there's going to be three different components, right? So there's going to be the proximate cause of the adaptation. So mm-hmm. why is it the case? Like, what are the mechanisms that keep us from finding our sibling or wanting to have sex with our siblings, right?
Okay.
But then there's this other part of the explanation, the ultimate part of the explanation. It's like, well, why would selection pressures have kept right. us from having sex with our siblings.
And that's because the offspring is not as fit, right? Like, don't our genes combine badly or something like that?
They do. Yeah. And this could be too much detail, but I can drill down into that a little bit. It's kind of interesting.
Sure. Yeah. I think I've read about it before, but I don't remember the details that much.
Yeah. Okay. So it's estimated that on average, any given person has between 1 and 7 of what are called fatal recessive alleles, right? And if these gene variants were expressed, they would have really, really bad effects, right? So a lot of the offspring with these expressed alleles would just die immediately, which is why they're called fatal recessives. But if they don't die immediately, then they have very severe problems.
Yeah.
So all of us have 1 to 7 of these kicking around in our genome on average.
So weird.
I know. But the reason that they're able to persist and that they don't cause us any problems is that their expression is masked by a dominant allele that keeps it from expressing, right?
Yeah.
So we can have these and have no problems, and our offspring will generally have no problems. So if you're mating with somebody who's unrelated, right? Back up. So the time when these fatal recessive would be expressed is when you have an offspring that gets 2 copies of the fatal recessive.
Yeah.
If you're mating with somebody who's unrelated, that's really, really unlikely to happen. But if you're mating with somebody who's closely related, the chances of that actually go up a ton.
Mm.
Right. And so you would expect there must be like a really strong selection pressure to keep us from mating with close kin. Right. Because there's this, you know, you have severely reduced fitness in your offspring.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the ultimate reason. But the proximate cause of that Westermark was suggesting was that it's not genetic relatedness per se, because we don't have direct access to that, right?
Yeah, we can't know that exactly.
Yeah. So instead, there's got to be some cue that ancestrally would have been related to relatedness, right? Something about our kin, right, that would have given us a statistically accurate cue that we are related to that person and shouldn't select them as mate.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of his hypothesis, he was saying that that mechanism was close childhood association.
Right.
So if you grow up in the same household with someone, then it's highly likely that you are siblings, for instance, and thus you should avoid them as mate.
So I would guess that you could predict that, you know, there is a chance of incest there's a higher chance of incest among siblings that didn't grow up together or something like that. Is that a prediction you make? Yeah.
Yep. And we'll get into some of that. So some of that research has been done more recently. But like in the 1970s, there were some research trying to look at quote unquote natural experiments where you could separate out the incest taboos from this element of growing up with someone being a barrier to sexual contact. Right. So for example, Wolf did a study in Taiwan. And he was examining these 2 different forms of marriage, right? One in which 2 people get married as adults, right? And another in which marriages were arranged, like usually at birth.
Wow.
And then the future bride moved into the house of the future groom. And so they were reared together and they were supposed to get married eventually.
Uh-huh.
So this is a situation in which the culture is explicitly trying to promote one behavior. And this hypothesized adaptation, if it really exists, should be prompting people to do the opposite.
Hmm.
And so what he did was to look at the success and the fertility of these 2 different types of marriages. He used 2 different data sources, right? One of them was objective and boring. It was the town records on like divorce and number of children produced, right? So that's good. That gives you a sense of the marital quality and also how many children they're producing, which should be related to how often they're having sex.
Yeah.
But then he also got this other data, right? He developed a relationship with a contact who was local to the area, and he got this guy to tell him all the town gossip, which was awesome, right? I love this. It was like, so they had this nice quantitative element, but you also had this qualitative data that gave you some insight as to, you know, why people were acting the way that they were. So the town record stuff bore out, right? You were more likely to get divorces in this minor form of marriage. You were more likely to get like drastically reduced number of children produced from that minor form of marriage. And also those were likely to be overestimates, because if there was cuckoldry going on, right, then it would probably be reported as a product of that marriage. But yeah, but anyway, you did get a lesser production of children. But the gossip was really where it got interesting. So the guy was telling him about how in this minor form of marriage, the parents of the new couple have to like lock them in a room together. And they like stand outside the door and the kids will try to escape so that they don't have to have sex with each other. And they're like beating them with a broom to get back into the room. And it's madness.
Wow.
They so don't want to have sex with each other at all.
That's so weird.
And they're not related.
Yeah.
But they do have this proximate cue to relatedness. And it seems to be a very strong predictor of this resistance. Right.
Yeah.
So this, they looked at other similar like cultural experiments and other studies. So they looked at, there's a structure in Lebanese fathers, brothers, daughters marriages. So this is where they promote marriages between, I think it's usually first cousin or second cousin. But the cousins are reared together like siblings and you get the same kind of effect. They've looked at Israeli kibbutzim, right? Where the kids are raised in classes together, generally not related, right? But they don't consider themselves to be appropriate marriage partners, even though the culture is, if not promoting, then at least not discouraging marriage within your classmates, right? Essentially. So you've got all these countercultural examples in which the behavior is lining up with this evolutionary prediction. Now, more recently, researchers have tried to look at this a little more closely and try to refine our thinking about what the adaptation looks like a little more closely, right? So Beck and Silverman, for instance, did a study in which they put out an ad and said, hey, we're interested in knowing about sexual contact between siblings. If that's you, please write in, right? So they collected the sample of people that were very likely to report having had some sort of sexual contact with their siblings. And then they were able to look at, like, code the types of sexual behavior. So, like, was it actual behavior that could be reproductive? So penile vaginal intercourse. Or was it, like, oral? Or was it manual stimulation? Was it playing doctor, right? Those kind of things. And so they looked at this as a function of whether or not the children had been separated for some period of time in childhood or whether they'd totally grown up together for, like, their entire childhoods. And what they found is that, you know, among the people who reported that they'd had penile vaginal intercourse, potentially reproductive success or sex, those people were disproportionately more likely to have not grown up together or to have been separated for some period of time during their childhood.
Yeah.
But, and this is the interesting part, the other stuff wasn't predicted by that. And so like, yeah, it's actually not totally uncommon for siblings to experiment with each other sometimes.
But not in the, in a way that could lead to offspring.
Exactly. Usually. Right. And so this was sort of it was a refinement of the Westermarck hypothesis. They were saying, you know, it's not necessarily a lack of sexual behavior in general. It seems to be a specific barrier to prevent potentially reproductive sexual activity.
Huh.
Yeah.
So interesting.
And this isn't, so like this isn't the only mechanism. This seems to be an overdetermined thing. So like if you're an older sibling, you have the benefit of being able to see your mother get pregnant and then give birth to the child and nurse the child. And so that's actually a better statistical cue to relatedness.
Oh,
and
okay.
So that's a tends to be a strong predictor. And when you have that, then the childhood co-residence doesn't predict things as strongly, right? Which is interesting. But it implies, right, that this is sort of an overdetermined thing to keep us from having sex with our siblings.
Right. Right. Now, I remember, I think at one point, Dawkins said, if we just started doing it, and then like you said, the recessive alleles, if we just allowed selection to take place on the offspring, that it would go away. Like,
that's true.
Eventually, after a bunch of offspring died off, like, horribly, and it would be very unpleasant. That would go away and we could just reproduce with our siblings, which is the weirdest thing to think about.
I know. I'm not particularly motivated to make that natural.
No, yeah. I think we're good how we are. But it's so interesting that like we could – it's such a strong intuition and instinct against it, but we could make it go away if we for some reason really wanted to.
It's kind of interesting.
It wouldn't be us.
Lab rats, right?
Yeah. Weird.
Yeah.
So how the hell did we get on this? What was this about?
Oh, I just wanted to give an example of some really good research that has really good convergent evidence. And, you know, there's elements of these countercultural examples that, you know, have weaknesses, right? I mean, they're not as rigorous as you can get with other types of methodologies, but you put all these different things together and you've got pretty good evidence that incest avoidance is a thing.
Right. So it's not a cultural thing, and it actually pretty much defeats the cultural, like in the cultures you describe where they're trying to encourage marriage between close, not siblings, but people.
Pseudo-siblings.
Live together or whatever, brought up together, reared together.
Right.
That it actually can pretty much defeat that almost. Like it's almost stronger, the drive to not reproduce with your sibling.
It is very strong evidence for it.
Interesting.
And as we collect more information on it, our ideas about how this works gets more and more refined. I mean, for instance, one possible hypothesis about incest avoidance would be that we recognize each other based on body odor, right? other species do that, like hamsters, for instance, they do that. And there's like some there's weak and kind of inconsistent evidence for humans indicating that we discriminate based on body odor. But it's not nearly as strong as these other proximate causes, or as the evidence for these other proximate causes. So yeah.
So I guess I want to. We're kind of running out of time here. So maybe we could cover some just generally. I'm wondering, how do you see when this big debate comes over sex differences and all that? What do you see as in general? Because I don't know. I mean, you got one side that thinks that everything is just culture and presumably another side that tends to emphasize, no, there's evolutionary differences between men and women or whatever. Where do you stand on that? Is there anything significant that you see as a major implication from that? Or are you just basically wanting to go with wherever the experiments lead us?
I'll say two things. One is that what an evolutionary perspective is doing is not saying it's biology, not culture, right? It is a highly interactionist perspective. So every hypothesis that we make is within the context of a certain environmental input or cultural constraint. I mean, it's a very highly interactionist point of view, right? Essentially, like I sometimes see the other side of this debate as kind of being blank slatists. And that might be a little bit unfair for some people, but that's what I feel like I'm arguing against. Not that culture is influential, but that it's the only influence, right?
Yeah.
But the other thing to say is that, like, yes, I want to know what's true. I want to know what the biological contributors to certain things are. And I think that having a better understanding of these mechanisms can only help us in trying to create unbiased systems. Like, for example, we know that we are really good at stereotyping. We're real, real good at that. And so that's
go us.
Yeah, I know. But like that's the reason that when you see a headline that's like study shows that, you know, men are different from women on this cognitive capability, that people are like, oh no, now there's going to be institutionalized sexism.
Yeah.
But what I really think we should be drawing from that is saying, okay, so we know we have these biases, and most of us don't want to discriminate on the basis of these biases. That's a value that most people have, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we also know that they are influential, even if we don't necessarily want them to be. So even if we want to have gender equality in our hiring practices, we know that those biases can creep in. So what I would say is that like we need to figure out ways to create more unbiased systems in hiring and in jury decisions and stuff that incorporate our knowledge of our likelihood to stereotype and make bad decisions on the basis of proximate rather than, you know, things that are actually relevant to the discussion. Right. Like with the jury thing, for instance, even if the jurists are really, really motivated to only attend to the evidence, there's very good evidence that the race of the person who's on trial and the gender and even the attractiveness of the person who's on trial all influence jury decisions.
Yeah.
So one thing we might think about is like, okay, rather than just telling people over and over, don't be sexist, don't be racist, maybe what we could do is reconsider whether we really need the defendant in the courtroom.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if we could blind this process a little bit, we'd have a better shot at reducing some of the systematic discrimination.
I wonder if that would have its own consequences, like we'd feel less empathy. So therefore, you know, like I wonder if that would maybe it could result in more guilty verdicts just because we don't see the person. So we don't care about what's going to happen to them or something. I don't know. That'd be interesting.
That's potentially true. But I mean, I think you could argue that lawyers are very aware of the role of empathy in those decisions and that they try to take advantage of it and use that.
Yeah.
I think you'd have a better shot at getting more unbiased or like more attention to the evidence that's relevant and less attention to these superficial details. But
interesting.
But you know, I mean, there's probably logistical problems with that too. I'm just saying, like, if you're coming at it from that perspective and you're clarifying in your mind the distinctions between these different issues, I think that we have a better chance of moving forward in a positive way and trying to reduce these things that we all agree are bad. Mm-hmm. Discrimination's bad.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, is there anything else you didn't get to that you want to address as regards the Richard Carrier episode?
A massive amount. However, I recognize we don't have unlimited time. So I put together a folder of articles. Ooh. And this includes some of the articles that we talked about today, like some of the primary research articles. And there's also some review things in there that for anybody who's interested in this area and wants to get a better sense of what evolutionary psych is like, they can go look at this.
Ooh, I like it.
So I'm requesting that I'm going to send you the link to a Google Drive that has all of those in there. And if you wouldn't mind associating that with the show notes or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, awesome. That's really cool. Thanks for doing that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll be able to check that out on our own. And now I feel I've completed the set. I'm glad it took a little while, but I'm glad you emailed me. I'm glad that we were able to do this so that we've got both sides on this view and on this topic. And thanks for that. I really appreciate it. And
thanks for having me on. This was great. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I love to learn more, and it's good to get someone who is actually in the field to defend it.
Yeah. And people should not take my word on this stuff, right?
Sure.
I mean, they should go back to the articles and see what they think. I put the monkey studies in there too, by the way, in case.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I like it. Thanks so much for joining me, Lindsay. And I guess that's all there is to it. Thanks for giving us the other perspective, and I'm really glad that we can make a more informed decision on this kind of thing now.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thanks to Lindsay for a great week of episodes there. There was a lot in the Richard Carrier interview that we didn't get to cover here. And that was because I had a lot of questions about things in general that I probably distracted the conversation with, but I was very curious to learn more about evolutionary psychology. So I'm glad that Lindsay indulged us, and that was really cool. So I want to thank my new patrons. Let's see. Here we go. Jesse, Crystal, and Benjamin Badger are my new patrons for this week. Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate the pledge. Hope you enjoy the new bonus content. And I got to thank my all-time greats, Hunter Ash, Jesse, Inciting Incident Podcast, Along Black Cock, Kaylee Razor, Zimu Zinu, Adrian Borschef, Jonathan Moyer, Jay Alden Walt, Blackhawks, Aeroscience Sharks, Franco Villarreal, Steve Sigmund, Peter Skelton, Brian Gareford, Dale, Matt, Garrett, Ian Rosano, Samantha, thank you guys so much for pledging an amount that dictates I have to thank you every week, which is my absolute pleasure because you guys are the best. All right. I'm very excited. You guys should be, if you could only know, very excited for things to come. Patrons will learn about them sooner than non-patrons, but in any case, it should be cool to see you next week for some great shows and a cool announcement. All right, see you then.